May Warren, this is tape two with Dick Sessoms on November 12th, 1996. We're still talking about co-education. So I want to know what happened as the process was going along. There was a lot of discussion before, and then there was the decision, and then there must have been quite a denouement.
Yeah, right.
So let's kind of walk through that.
All right. Well, I can only do this in episodic kinds of ways. My first phone call was from a New Jersey alumnus who called me from a phone booth, so help me God, on the New Jersey Turnpike. He says, I have just heard on national radio that my university is considering going co-ed. This decision hadn't even been made. That's the way I learned. I mean, this story broke in the Newport News newspaper, got on the AP wire, on the AP radio network. John was interviewed by a young alumnus in the Newport News Daily Press, and it just went all over the country just like that. And so we were obviously behind the eight ball before we knew what hit us. And that's when the big PR experience I had dealt with some things like I won't go into it, but the President Johnson one time was cornered by the rector of Bruton Parish Church during the Vietnam bombing time, and was asked in a situation where he couldn't respond, captive audience, why we were bombing North Vietnam. Can you imagine this? And it was made, I was working with the White House press on that particular occasion. We had a gridiron dinner in Williamsburg. The entire press corps and all the great editors and whatnot of the Washington Power media were in Williamsburg. And we were dealing with a national incident, where it made every newspaper in the world headlines. U.S. president lectured by small Episcopal preacher. and I remember how we dealt with that from the PR standpoint. We went for the national picture. We just said, Bruton Parish Church has no relationship to Colonial Williamsburg. We were sponsoring the president's visit, and that wasn't entirely the case. I mean, the rector of Bruton Parish Church was the man that convinced John D. Rockefeller Jr. to restore the whole of Williamsburg. And I released, or was one of the PR people that worked with our president to release a statement about this thing. And we called the rector's performance, we used three words that really put our cap right on it: exquisite bad taste. And that got picked up all over the country. Now, we got our lumps locally. People said, how dare you guys say that? We didn't care about what, I shouldn't say care, but we were less concerned about what the Richmond Times-Dispatch thought than what the Paris Herald Tribune was going to write. So anyway, that background gave me a little one-up, at least in terms of handling this issue. I advised John. He didn't listen to me, of course. John didn't need my advice on many things, and he didn't take it on it when he could have. But I said, John, you should take yourself off the point a little bit. You're leading this charge. You've got to let the rector and the board run this thing. John, though, was not built that way. So John Wilson took the whole, he was the point man on this whole issue. And he took an awful lot of abuse. Ann Wilson, in her memoirs, I hope she's forgotten those days, but I happen to know that they got a lot of midnight and 1 and 2 a.m. phone calls of an abusive nature. And those were not happy times here. This was a very emotional issue, and people got a little nasty about it. And there were lots of people talking about, how can you impeach this president? How can we get rid of this guy? How can we send the hokey packing? I remember getting I remember getting a annual fund. In those days, the annual fund gifts, many of them, were coming into the alumni office. And I remember a check, a small check came in, and in the little section where the alumnus is given to write it, some news about themselves. There was no news about him. It was just, quote, send the Hokie packing. There were a lot of people. Gosh, I was with John and Ann up at the Congressional Country Club in Washington, D.C., where, in fact, an alumnus who should have had better manners, quite honestly, stood up after John's talk to the alumni chapter. That would have occurred probably in that following fall. This is now the fall, maybe November of 1983. And absolutely confronted him and said, how dare you, in those words, how dare you come from Blacksburg, Virginia, down to my university and presume to tell us what's good for Washington and Lee University? How dare you? And that's the sort of thing that we were confronted with. And Waller Dudley, a trustee at the time, stood up and defended John that night, as did other alumni. And there were people who would get up in that situation and sort of shout down. I remember one night we were in San Francisco, the same thing happened. Alumnus sort of made a spectacle of himself that night and walked out, walked right out of the room, slammed the door. And of course, that tended to upset, what upset anybody. I remember John saying to me one time, you know, no one likes to be disliked. You had to really feel for John, and you had to admire his courage, because he truly came here and heard from the faculty and heard from so many people that this was something that this university needed to do. It there's no question that John was of a mind to do it before he came, but he still needed to have that sort of support. And he got it here from the faculty, 95% of whom, or at least 85% of whom, were fully favoring co-education. And the only PR kind of advice that I wish he'd listened to me a little bit on was, I wanted him, after a time, after the issue was fully out there and everybody sort of knew it and that what we were dealing with, and we'd done a survey, we'd done the famous, when are you going to stop beating your wife survey, and all that, and trying to get some sense of the alumni's reaction to all this. I remember saying to John, John, take my advice and announce where you stand now. You've played this down the middle. But now go ahead and say that you're going to use every ounce of energy, bend every muscle you've got to persuade this university and its constituency to co-educate. And he didn't. He continued to play it right down the middle, right up to the day that the vote was taken on July 14th, 1984. And of course he voted, well, I shouldn't talk about who voted for whom or what, but it was obvious that John was pushing this. I think his presidency would have been a little easier later on had he gone ahead and announced, because what you heard in the aftermath for years and years and years, followed John, frankly, to his grave, was it wasn't that I, you know, disliked or wasn't the decision, I just didn't like the way you did it. So many people felt like that they were being misled or in so many words, lied to. We could have helped our situation had John, in my view, said, this is where I stand, right or wrong. You can fire me if it fails. And he would have gone. There's no question in anybody's mind. John would have probably left because he didn't want to be the president of an all-male college. He saw the huge potential that we have realized. He saw that. He understood that. And this was the kind of college he wanted to be president of, and the college that, that evolved under him, which we're all so proud of. But he didn't want. Anyway.
Now, where were you the day of the decision?
Oh, I was in the room. Jim Ballinger, in his wonderful way, all of us on the staff thought that there would, that would be done in executive session. But Jim said no. Now the board had decided their rules in advance of, you know, it was going to have to be not just a simple majority, but it was going to have to be a decisive, two-thirds of the board would have to make this sweeping a fundamental change. In the, but Jim said, and I remember him saying this that day, all of you have been a part of this all the way through this thing. And this is no time for the deans and the directors of admission and the alumni secretaries. He wants us all in the room. And so he says, you've been with us all the way. You want, I want you here for this whole thing. And it was an emotional day, a weekend. It was a special board meeting in July of 1984. And of course, the earlier meetings that year had dealt with the subject. And in the fall, of course, we were dealing with the whole alumni reaction, and people were worried about people will turn off the gift, we won't support the university, et cetera. We had studied the admissions. We looked at the financial implications of going co-ed and all that sort of thing. All this was discussed in February and also at the May meeting. And it was decided that there would be a special meeting. And John wanted to make this decision. Remember, John took office in January of 83, and the full fury of the debate hit that summer and early fall. But he felt like he couldn't get his program, his administration, moving until this issue was resolved one way or the other. So that's about all anybody was talking about. I mean, if you talk about an entire university, well, thank gosh the faculty kept teaching, but the administration was entirely focused for an entire year on this subject. Not much else was being even discussed. I remember, as an aside, I remember Bill McHenry and I were talking about the creation of the Athletic Hall of Fame, and Bill was really pushing that, and I remember saying to Bill on the phone, Bill, that's about, let's say, on a scale of 1 to 10, I'm not even sure it's a 1 on the list here, but we'll talk about that later. Well, anyway, so the issue was resolved at the special meeting in July. It happened to be on Bastille Day, July 14th. But I remember that weekend going to bed the night on the July 13th, thinking that the motion would be defeated. I honestly did. Now, there was no question that the majority of the board were in favor, but one of the strongest proponents of co-education on the final day of kind of debate, they were going to take the vote on the 14th, but on the final session and on the 13th, I remember so well, one of the trustees who had been the most articulate, one of the more articulate trustees, said the only nagging question that he had in his mind about the whole decision was that he had seen, and he was, we're talking about, he was a corporate chieftain, he was a major corporation, and he said, I have seen so many mergers occur in corporate America. And I have seen the spark and the light go out of so many companies when they were gobbled up or, you know, merged. He says, the only nagging doubt I've got in this whole thing, I know it's right in so many ways, but I am worried about that special, intangible thing that this university certainly has, and I would hate to think that we'd make a decision tomorrow that would in any way cause that to disappear or to be altered. And I thought, oh my gosh, that might swing some thinking in this room. I went to bed and I told Sam, I said, you know, I thought this thing was slam dunk. I don't know, that So there were people up during the night. One of our trustees was up at 4 a.m. Jim Balance, he says, I know he was up because I was awake and I heard him walking around the key to that general motel. And some of them made statements. They went around the room. The last thing Jim Balance did before the vote, he said, now, we're going to take the vote. And this was around 10 o'clock in the morning. And he said, the last thing I want to do is I want to give everybody one last opportunity to speak. And so 25 trustees at the time, and 23 of them were there. There were two people who voted by telephone, one from Ireland and another one from his deathbed. But they went around the room, and every trustee who chose to speak spoke his final, made his last stand. And there were some tears. There were some emotional statements made, pro and con, about it. And then the vote was taken. And as we all know, it came out 17-7 in favor. Well, Jeff Hanna was then the director of the Washley News Bureau. And we had a waiting press score. This was a big event after all. I had a house guest that weekend. A great friend of mine was the associate editor of the National Geographic, Joseph Judge, now deceased. But Joe and his wife were visiting me that weekend. I'll get back to that a while later. But we had a press conference, and Jim Ballinger and John Wilson, rector and president, along with two trustees, Edgar Shannon and Chris Compton. Compton was to represent the no vote, and Shannon, who had educated the University of Virginia, co-educated UVA on the pro side. So I remember my weekend house guest listening on the radio. I guess it wasn't a live broadcast TV, but listening to the radio, I guess, and the live broadcast of the press conference, which occurred over at the C School right after the decision was rendered. And he said, Dick, I've lived my life in Washington, D.C. Press conferences and people are, you know, all that sort of thing is a way of life up here. I have never heard such an articulate press conference in my entire life as a justice of the Supreme Court of Virginia, Chris Compton. And here's this very bright man, Jim Balance, who's one of the brightest people you'll ever know. And of course, Wilson, we all know his articulation, and then of course, there's Edgar Shannon. And the four of them talking about the decision. And of course, from Chris Compton's point of view, how he and other trustees who had voted against the decision would now close ranks and would bend every muscle they had to making this work, and they did. For me, I was glad the decision was over. The whole year had been an unsettling experience where I was not able to really get some things started in this new job that I wanted. But I did recognize one thing, and that is I had the entire alumni constituency, not a single one of whom wasn't on the edge of his or her seat, if there were a few female alums out there, law alums. And that was a great advantage for me. Look, I got this choir out there, and they're on the edge of their seat. So I was going to use it. I determined early on how I would try to conduct myself personally. And I really worked very hard, now that I had the whole constituency around, not to let that love go back to sleep. So that was the summer that I went to see John later on, and I said, John, we're not going to allow a gap to grow up here. I want you to take a trip with me, and I want to go right at the heart primarily of the southern southwest constituency. I said, actually, to back up for a second, it didn't know a geographical kind of, there were just as many alumni in New York City or in Bangor, Maine for that matter, or San Francisco upset with us as it did in Birmingham. But it, at the same time, the even though we're a national college, we have a Southern character. There is a Southernness about Washington. And so I said to him, I want to take the best show we've got on the road, and I want you and Ann to fly into Texas and meet me. And I want to take the best thing we've got on the road and go right at the heart of the Southern constituency immediately. Let's don't let this thing fester. There are a lot of people mad. A lot of people have pushed away from the table and said that. I remember getting a gift one time, and the author said, take a good look at this check and its signature. It's the last one you'll see of this signature and this amount. He was a Lee associate then. And I might tell you, this particular alum I'm referring to has not made a gift since. I mean, he meant it. So there were people out there, and they may be few and far between now. We weaned them back in many cases, but there were some hard feelings, you know. Well, we had a freshman that year, who was really a wonderful pianist named Robert Viano, and he was a Juilliard. He should have been at Juilliard, but he's at Washington because he broke his wrist. And just before he should have gone to Juilliard, and he came to Washington. He's one of Bill Hartog's greatest discoveries. And he was a full tuition scholarship. Wonderful. He was a franchise player for your fine arts department in music. So I said, John, I want to take Robert Viena. I want to take him on the road with Southern Comfort, the singing group. I'm an alumni secretary without a 185 piece marching band, and I've got Southern Comfort. We're still all male now. We didn't have any women here yet, so Southern Comfort's the only thing I've got to work with. So let's take Southern Comfort on the road. Let's mend some fences. That was my idea, and so he agreed. I love him. I said, here's what I want to do, and I want to go to Birmingham. I think I can recount the stops. We did 10 alumni eight alumni chapters in 10 days, and it was an extraordinary trip. Driving two athletic vans. I got two athletic vans, and Buddy Atkins drove one, and I drove the other, and Sally was with me. Sally and Buddy Atkins, who was my associate, alumni secretary, and 12 young men, including this magnificent pianist. So we started, and we went to Birmingham and Shreveport. Believe you me, to drive from Birmingham to Shreveport's a full-day drive, and we were performing. I was making a little alumni talks. I got a very chilly reception in Birmingham. That's okay. I learned. I didn't say so much. And by the time I got to Shreveport, I'd gotten my remarks down to about 30 seconds and let the kids do the singing. I was forgotten what I was out there for. It wasn't what I was going to say. It's let the kids, let the talent show here. So I learned my lesson quickly. But then we went to Fort Worth, and my buddies in Fort Worth, some of the people I referred to earlier, entertained us there for a couple of days, took us to Joe T. Garcia. We spent a couple of days recuperating from the long drive, and John and Ann met us in Fort Worth. And so he made four straight alumni chapter dinners and talks, and was drawing record number of alumni at all these places. After all, this huge decision had been made. I guess this was had come along that fall, because I guess freshman women were here. We did have freshman women here that year, that following fall. And so anyway, we went to Dallas, Fort Worth, and then Dallas, and then San Antonio, and then Houston, in that order. So we did Birmingham, Shreveport, Fort Worth, Dallas, San Antonio, Houston. Then we drove to New Orleans, and then we caught Atlanta on the way home. So it was a hook. It was a real Tennessee, around the horn and back up. Now, John and Ann
flew and did the four Texas chapters with us, four straight nights. And I remember, John, this is the beginning, frankly, of all the, I'm proud of this, I have to say this, this was the beginning of what has now become an absolute tradition of Southern Comfort, later Jubilee, and the University course going on these alumni trips. So John supported because when the little things, John loved little things that he appreciated. And I remember we got in the car. We were staying, I had the kids, of course, the 12 young men, staying in alumni homes. That was the whole deal, was that, you know, they would be out there, they'd be mending the fences a little bit for us. John and Ann and Sally and I were staying at the hotel there, and we got the kids in the van to go over to Dallas, just a 30-mile ride. And so we gave John and Ann a ride in the van with us. We had a room. And I had some Dallas alumni lining up some wonderful things for us to do. We sang at the burn unit of the Parkland Hospital. And we did some PR things in town, you know. You know me. So I was doing, we sang at the Shriners Hospital. And we're talking about newspaper article, Dallas Morning News picture. So, but as we left the hotel, I had a requirement, I had a rule, and the kids were good about this. They didn't get out of the car at the other end unless they had written a note, a thank you note, for their host. That really impressed John. He loved that. He got in the car, and I started handing out the car, you know, the letterhead and the little note paper and the stamps and the whole thing, and they were all writing their little notes. And he loved that. And he said, "You're doing this all over the country this way?" I said, "I sure am." So we had this great PR experience, and we did the meetings in the other cities, New Orleans, and came back. The next year, of course, the university course, we now had women on the campus. And I remember a representative of the Gordon Spice's chorus came over and said, "We heard about that great Southern Comfort trip you took last February during the Washington holiday break. Will you help us with our trip this coming year?" I said, "Where are you going to go?" "Well, we want to go to Florida." And I said, "I'm not going to help you." And Leah, I can see that young man's face right now, and he was president of course. And I said, "Now, if you go where the university wants you to go and needs you to go, I'll give you all kinds of help." "Well, where is that?" I said, "I want you to go to Baltimore, Philadelphia, New York, and Boston. We're going to work the Northeast corridor now." And so that's what we did. This time we graduated to a bus, 43 passenger bus, women aboard now. And working out homes for, I don't know, we must have had 35 kids on that bus. And so that was great though. We went to New Jersey and whatnot. And one of the great things that came to me as a result of that trip was that Steve Stevenson, bless his heart, our deceased late and great friend, who taught German here for 40-some years, class of 42, stopped me on the colony a week or two after that trip and said, "I want to thank you for what you did." And I said, "What on earth?" He said, "Well, there's the brightest freshman woman I've ever had in German. You know, I've never had women in my class, but I've got a very bright freshman, forget her gender, but a very promising student, and she has been a little bit unhappy, and I was afraid that we were going to lose her. But she's in the chorus, and she took this trip with y'all, and for the last week, she has been in the homes of alumni all throughout the Northeast. And she's come back, and she has said to me, 'I'm never going to leave this university. I love this place. I love the alumni.'" And I said, "God, Steve, all I have thought about is what I was doing for the alumni by taking these bright students out there. I never thought about it working the other way, that the students would become so in love with the alums." And that worked.
I've interviewed some of those alums who went on that trip.
Really?
It was a very important trip. Before you go on, though, I want to ask.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm getting way
away. In that trip with Southern Comfort,
you had these students going and staying with the alumni. There were a lot of students here who were not very excited about co-education.
Yes.
Were the students in Southern Comfort all pro?
Not all, not all, but I'll tell you what, as I said to John, I said, John, what were we really going to do that night in these four Texas cities were especially? We had Robert Vino playing, and he did this everywhere we went. There's some things that on the piano are just so very flashy. So we got him to play the Hungarian Rhapsody, which is a very, oh boy, it's a tune that everybody knows. And he, you know, it's about a 9-minute piece. And of course, John, we had it worked out so that after Robert played, John spoke. So we had Robert play during dessert. And so we killed the dessert time by, and therefore when John came on to make his talk, he was able to always say, that is the kind of talent that I want this university to have throughout the student body, if you could say. But so we used Robert in that way, and that set the scene, that set the tone, I think, for what we were trying to accomplish. And even though there may have been a few kids in the band who had their own private doubts, I found in the students themselves that they were looking forward to the women coming aboard. I mean, may have been a few, but young people are just plain resilient anyway. Even those who were coming from this staunchly conservative kind of, ruin the college kind of thing, I think that they were curious maybe. So there wasn't, I don't think they were out there with any agenda to slay the president or to undermine what we were up to. And I think what more took hold was the alumni saw in the talent that they had, and in the talent especially centered in Robert Vino. And as I said to John, look, at the end of the evening, John, I'm going to have 200 people in the Houston alumni chapter on their feet, shoulder to shoulder, singing the Wash and Lay Swing. I promise you that. And it happened in 8 cities. And that trip had as much to do with alumni. Alumni talk to each other. We find, now that there are faxes, it's amazing. But whenever something is going on this campus, oh boy, there's more communication going on between alums. So, like a ripple in a pond, that trip really had an impact, I think. Not to take too much credit for that one thing. I did other things that probably had more lasting effect. When we got women here, I'm going to talk about this because this is something that very few people know. I decided that I would get a point card and eat in the dining hall as soon as women arrived. I had a great relationship with the men students here. I loved them, and I still do. I started Capricorn and all those things in those days before we had women on campus to serve the alumni program needs. But I really wanted to get close to the gals. We only had 103 or 104. And Maine, by the end of the month of September, their freshman year, I think I can say this, I knew every single one of them. Knew them by first name. Because I ate at a dining hall. Now here's this gray-haired guy walking over there eating with freshmen. Not every day, but a couple times a week. Moving around the dining hall. I did this. Well, I figured it out before they arrived, of course. I knew that I had to get my arms around them, get them around them quick and love them to death and keep them. Because I knew that later on, when they graduated, if I could get them to really work for us, be the alums I hope they would become, we'd be better off. So I got women into Capricorn. We set up the rules of Capricorn about only having juniors and seniors, and I never doubted that, the wisdom of that. I wanted track records. I wanted people who had demonstrated some campus leadership before we took them into this organization in their junior and senior year. But as soon as the women got to be second semester sophomores, I'd already picked out three or four that I really, the people I really wanted to have in there. And so we got them involved. Now, when they were in Capricorn, beginning in, I think, their junior year, a little known fact, and I did this in Virginia, I took them to alumni meetings when they were juniors. Women took them to Roanoke, to meetings of the Blue Ridge chapter in Charlottesville or Stanton, Waynesboro area, Lynchburg, Richmond. If I could fill up a car with four or five very bright, intelligent young women and take them to an alumni meeting in Roanoke and have the alumni meet them and then also have them meet the, you know, see what this is all about, talk about their experiences. And I did this, and it's paid off because as soon as we graduated these gals, some of them immediately became leaders in the alumni chapters. I have the one of my most treasured letters is from Alexa Salzman, who was the first woman elected to the alumni board. And she was, of course, a graduate of Capricorn. Dallas Haywood succeeded a year or two later. Dallas was in Capricorn. I picked them right off the bat. I knew who was going to be movers and shakers later on.
You picked well. I've interviewed both of them.
Yeah. Well,
they're stunning.
Yeah, well, they are, and but there are lots. I mean, you couldn't go wrong. It's just a matter of who you are lucky to get. But I was in a position, and I think I was sensitive to making sure that women got off to a good start, and as alums. So I, in some cases, thrust them into some positions, maybe ahead of their time or. Whatever, but I mean, I had to depose a couple of chapter presidents to make sure that Alexa Salzman got to be the chapter president out in San Francisco. Why? Because she had to earn her way on that alumni board. You just couldn't put her there because she was female. You had to develop the service track record. So this is all strategy. John Wilson, I think, was amazed that I was thinking about this at the time. He was sort of concerned with whatever the next curveball coming down the plate was, and I think he approved, but he did tell me one time that he was astonished that I was at the point of their junior year in college was trying to move them around to nearby alumni meetings, and that was all part of my notion of getting them involved and getting them, and then once it, I might add, one of my allies or a huge ally were all the law female alums, because lots of times I would take them on private little trips and just go and have lunch. One time I took some gals here over to Roanoke just to meet with the women attorneys in Roanoke. Dick and his harem, I guess it was. But I had probably 20 female attorneys in Roanoke meet me one time when I brought a carload of gals over. A couple of them were also law women, but several undergraduates. For all I know, Dallas Haywood might have been in that car that trip. But anyway, I said to him, look, you're going to graduate from Washington. Some of these days I'd say to the undergraduates. And, you know, one of the things you're going to need in your life is an attorney. So why not a Washington Lee attorney? And better yet, why not a woman Washington Lee attorney? So I had this thing going, and the women who were law alumni, alums, kept assuring me and then saying, you're worrying excessively about this. Don't worry. It's going to take care of itself. They'll make their way. They've made their way through all that T-shirt, you know, bumper sticker, all the grief that they got from the upperclassmen. These are tough kids. and they're in this thing because they're pioneers, and they're, don't worry, they'll do well out here. But the group that I was looking to for the early support were the women who were law alums, and I used them, and they didn't mind my using them in that sense. They were good allies, and they were glad to be called upon. In my experience, I have never known a situation where an alum has said no to a legitimate request for help. And of course, asking them for help is the greatest cultivational tool that you can ever have as a gift officer, because of the involvement then leads on to the investment.
I'll tell you, Dick, when I started a year ago,
mm-hmm.
and I'd go into Frank's office, Frank, would you mind calling Roger Mudd for me and letting mm-hmm. him know that it's okay to talk to him? Well, you just go ahead and call him.
Yeah.
And I started making these calls, and all I had to say mm-hmm. was I was from Washington and Lee. Mm-hmm. And I got right through the secretary, mm-hmm. right to mm-hmm. the person. I'm talking to Roger. I'm talking to John McGowan. Mm-hmm. And now I'm completely relaxed and it's perfectly normal.
Well, it's an.
And I was astonished at how easy it is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All you have to do, and
exactly.
you know, at first I thought, oh, they're all going to think I'm calling them for money.
Mm-hmm.
That was not an mm-hmm. issue.
Mm-hmm.
What can I do for what? Is there something you want for Washington and Lee? Let me know.
Mm-hmm.
What can I do?
It's a magic name.
It's astonishing.
You pick up the phone, all you have to say, Washington and Lee, and it's magic. There's no question about it.
Or better yet, WNL.
Yeah, and we're...
Get it as mushed up as possible, that WNL.
Yeah, we're the beneficiaries, those of us who are stewards now of the whole operation, are the beneficiaries of that great reputation. And like the finest thing I ever heard someone say about the honor system and the whole issue of character and the union of character and intellect here and all that makes this place special in my mind is an attorney told me that he says, when I deal with another attorney and I discover that he is a Washington Lee person, I'm a bit more on my toes. I said, now why is that? He says, because I know he expects more of me. I thought that's a beautiful thing to say, because we have this great common denominator. And I recently had a visit with John Elrod about the 250 matter and what we were doing with that regard. And I remember saying to John that thanks to his wonderful deanship, after all, he's hired most of our present faculty in those 11 years. More than half of them, I guess, have come along during John's deanship. And I said, thanks to John Wilson's great presidency, I would like to say that academic excellence, that tired old phrase, is now a given at this university. We really, truly compare ourselves rightfully with Williams and Swarthmore and Davidson and Amherst and all the great private national liberal arts colleges. And he says, I fully agree. I knew he wouldn't, and I knew I had him. I said, therefore, John, what is it that distinguishes this university from Swarthmore and Williams and Harvard? I mean, not Harvard, but Davidson and the other liberal arts colleges. And he's a bright man. He said, well, what do you think it is? You speak first. I said, I have a very clear idea of what it is, and I think it is the heroic examples of the lives of George Washington and Robert E. Lee and all they stood for, and the example of public service and everything that we all wrap up in our general words when we talk about character and the issue of the honor system and whatnot. And I said, that I think should be our theme for as we move forward for the 250. I can't imagine it any other way. And I said, I do believe strongly that we should have a theme. And I know we don't have one right now. We don't seem to really have a focus theme. But I said, in my experience, themes inform and not only illuminate the specific design of things, but they also your general design. So I would be moving in that direction. We had just an interesting conversation about it. But anyway, a lot of funny things. I'm going back to the thread now. A lot of funny things happen, and I'll try to tell you a couple of things that just come to my mind.
Before you do, let me put the mic up.